now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yo. Technology. What is it all about?
Here you go. You want to try a chive?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of chives.
Are you? Mm-hmm. I was going to say, people don't eat them all that frequently.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Farming. It hasn't changed much since we humans first started harvesting wheat and barley in the Fertile Crescent back around 10,000 BC. Of course, there's been advances. The plow, fertilizers, genetically modified seeds. But broadly, farmers are still playing the same high-stakes game they were all those millennia ago. Plant your crops and then hope and pray the weather cooperates. But Mother Nature is increasingly unpredictable and the stakes are higher than ever. We now have more than 7 billion mouths to feed. There's got to be a better way, doesn't there? Well, this week's guest on Danny in the Valley thinks there is. In fact, he thinks he's found it. Matt Barnard is the co-founder of Plenty, an indoor farming startup that just raised an astounding $200 million from the SoftBank Vision Fund, an investment Goliath recently formed by Saudi Arabia and Japan's SoftBank to place huge bets on the next generation of technologies that they think will change the world. And they're not the only investors, of course. Others include Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, and Eric Schmidt of Google.
Wow.
I visited Plenty's giant warehouse in South San Francisco last week to see for myself just how it works.
So this gets much closer to what you'll see in one of our production farms that's actually going to market.
What is this?
This is Rainbow Chart.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Now the facility was under heavy construction while I was there, but I did get to see a few crop rooms. After, of course, I suited up in a white hazmat suit, put little booties over my shoes, sanitized my hands, and had my digital recorders sanitized. But what I saw were 15-foot-high towers of lettuce and chives and chard growing sideways toward perfectly symmetrical vertical rows of what looked like little Christmas lights.
What you see here, though, that's not really representative of what you'll see in a farm is each crop, each varietal has its temperature, air quality, humidity, lighting needs. Ultimately, what the farms will be are 1,200 square foot rooms with really one crop per room.
This one room is like the equivalent of a very big farm in the real world, traditional world.
Yes. A really good analogy that we use sometimes that helps people to visualize is if you take a couple of soccer fields, what a conventional farm can grow in those, we can grow in a goal.
In a trailer back outside the warehouse, I sat down with Barnard to talk about the future of food and why farming is so ripe for disruption. Hope you enjoy it.
I grew up on a commercial fruit farm. From the time I was a kid, what I was clear on is that I liked everything we grew on our farm. I loved it. And whenever we brought fresh produce at the store, I didn't like it. Now, here in California, it's a bit of a different story because we're right near where most of those crops are grown when you talk about fresh fruits and vegetables. But in Wisconsin, if you're not growing it yourself, the rest of the year you're getting things that are grown in California or in another country, and they're spending days, weeks, and thousands of miles in trucks and distribution centers. So I knew that I didn't like what we didn't grow on the farm. I then, as an adult, have moved around the U.S., and now living in California, close to the heart of fruit and vegetable production, there are things that I love that I didn't know that I liked. I didn't know I liked watermelon. I couldn't understand why people ate it. And now I eat the stuff like 4 days a week.
Yeah. Good watermelon is great.
It's amazing.
It's not mealy.
Exactly. And in Wisconsin, it's always mealy.
Right. Oh, it's terrible.
Because it's already spent a week on a truck. So I left the farm planning to never come back. because what I experienced of it as a kid was that it's pretty hard because your livelihood is completely out of your control.
So did you actually work out in the fields and pick apples and stuff?
As a kid, I thought I was working out in the field.
Right, I understand.
Right. Knowing what I know now.
You weren't being that big a help.
That was theater, yeah. So then as a professional, I kind of grew up as a professional in the wireless telecommunications industry and ended up running a firm that engineered, designed, and deployed the networks for all the wireless carriers.
So you built wireless infrastructure?
That's right.
So are you an engineer?
I play one on TV.
Right.
No, I have built and run companies mostly populated by engineers, but I am not an engineer by training. I did that. I think of it as utility scale technology infrastructure. And I view what we're doing here is essentially building out a global agricultural utility where we're bringing reliable food production of food that's much higher quality year-round to people everywhere. I kind of got that exposure to engineering and deploying on a mass scale, utility scale technology. And then from there, I was in the private equity world for a bit. I spent time looking for ways to invest in water technology. It was there that I learned that 70 to 80% of all the world's water consumption is due to ag. And so if you want to fix the water system, you got to fix ag. And then finally, I got back into utility scale technology. I was brought in to help scale a firm that did cellular smart grid. These are large ecosystems of hardware and software for electric, water, and gas utilities to help them kind of both spread demand across the day cycle as well as to damp down demand a bit. That business ended up getting bought by the industry giant, and I went about looking for the next thing to do.
What company was that?
It was purchased by a company called Itron.
Right.
So I went about looking for the next thing I wanted to do and found this industry.
Is it an industry?
Well, it's not. I found what was then, at best, it was a cottage industry, but it was this kind of nascent area of exploration at that point in time. And so we really started off by looking at, hey, let's understand the entire business from seed all the way through into someone's home. And how do we get people, better food for the same as or less money and make it more accessible to everywhere? Because, here in the United States, for example, we've got 4% of the world's population, and we're consuming almost a third, more than a quarter, of the world's fresh produce.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Actually consuming or purchasing? Because a lot of it is thrown away, right? Because
Well, sure. So yes, this is on a purchase basis. Sure, this is on a like per dollar of purchasing. I would say that the U.S. it has the most robust system of counting what is purchased. So there's a little bit of probably a disproportionate counting, but also we have almost 20% of the world's GDP. So that drives a little bit of the disparity as well, and also a very rich and efficient logistics system, which is super important for fresh fruits and vegetables to travel thousands of miles and still even have an inkling of salability left to them.
You sell that last company, and then you just kind of stumble upon this, or obviously you had some interest in this.
Yes.
But how do you go about saying, okay, well, I like farming, but farming sucks.
Yeah.
To, I'm going to create an indoor farming company.
Yeah. It tweaked my interest just enough to really engage in a deep dive into the landscape of agriculture and the food system generally. So we mapped out the entire system, like I said, from seed all the way into someone's home.
And is this your team from the previous companies that you brought along?
So one person that I was introduced to, one of our co-founders here, through actually a company that I'd worked with, an investment firm that I worked with in the past. We started there, eventually met Nate Story, who's another co-founder and our chief science officer, who's been working on this and related growing technology for, a good decade or so, starting with his PhD work. And we started mapping out, hey, these are all of the people, the companies, the parts of the chain that touch the food as it goes from seed into someone's home. How do we fix this?
Was there anything that you found particularly shocking or like, oh my God, this is totally inefficient?
I was never so clear that perishable food spent so much time in the chain. It's spending about 2 weeks in the supply chain, much of it in the store.
So if I go to Safeway and buy a banana, that's probably what, I don't know, been picked 3 weeks ago, a month ago?
So crop by crop, this can differ pretty widely. Rarely do you get something in the store that's less than a week old, from the day it was picked. That's about as good as it gets.
Which is interesting because, for example, I'm from here, but I used to live in the UK.
Yeah.
And the tomatoes are terrible.
Yes.
In the UK.
Yes.
Because I think most places. Yeah, they're imported from Spain or from Italy. Uh-huh. And then you go to Spain or Italy and the tomatoes are amazing.
Yeah.
But something happens, or I think the requirements for transport mean that they have to be picked too early or whatever. They're overripe or underripe or what have you.
There are several things. So the supply chain has done some amazing things in order to get people more fresh food, but it has truly distorted what fresh means. Like if you look at an apple, for example, there are only two apple harvests a year, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere. So if you're eating an apple in the Northern Hemisphere that's outside of September and October, you're eating an apple that's about a year old. You'll notice, like, sometimes you get a nice, crisp, sweet apple, and other times you get that mealy texture you mentioned before. The taste will be very muted and often just gone. That's because what they do is they put them in indoor cellars and gas them with a heavy gas like nitrogen to crowd out the oxygen so that they age
much more slowly
and they don't spoil.
Right.
But after about a month or so, they're essentially nothing but fiber, some sugar, and water. They've lost most of their nutritional content, and then they start to lose their flavor. But they're edible. You know, they're saleable and edible.
And so if I ate one of those apples, mm-hmm. and then I went to an apple orchard in season and took another one off, and you analyze those on a cellular level, would they have different nutritional content?
Oh, you would know. Yeah, so the compounds that hold the flavors that we care about, the bolder the flavor, the more volatile the compound, generally speaking. And flavor profile, the boldness of it is correlated with nutritional content. So the less taste something has, generally speaking, the less nutrient content it has.
Right.
You'll notice if you eat an apple fresh off the tree, you're going to get a very different experience than what you get in the store.
Or like you go fishing and you eat a fish that you've just caught. It tastes entirely different from what you purchased
in
the store.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. So I didn't know about the thousands of miles. If I had thought about it, I'd know. But I didn't know about the thousands of miles. I didn't know about the week minimum. I didn't know apples are a year old on average when you eat them. Tomatoes, the reason they are, as you said, is in part because of some great innovations that have helped to drive down the cost of the tomato. Like, for example, selecting over generations for plants that color uniformly when they are ripe made it easier for pickers to get the timing right, to go quickly through the field and just pick what's ready. That, though, has the side effect of now reducing the amount of sugars that the fruit can produce by almost a third. So now you have a tomato with much less sugar content. You have a tomato that's been bred for toughness, so it can be shipped thousands of miles. Like, California produces more fresh market tomatoes than any country on the earth. And then most of those tomatoes end up traveling thousands of miles to get somewhere. But so in order to make that true, you've got to make a pretty tough beefsteak tomato. So that's why I'm betting that you've never eaten a beefsteak tomato like an apple, because that's not a fun experience.
No.
You've got a tough skin.
Yeah.
The skin, by the way, can withstand twice the amount of impact than your car bumper by regulation here in the United States of America.
How can that be true?
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
So because it's funny you say that, because we were driving the other weekend back from Tahoe, and I just saw a couple of trucks loaded full of tomatoes, and they were just thrown in like piles.
Uh-huh, exactly.
They were not protected.
Yeah, so the ones on the bottom have to be able to withstand all that crushing
weight. And I was just thinking, there's no way that there's those, you know, most of those tomatoes are going to be terrible. But.
They're saleable because they're so tough.
Right.
We grow, one thing to know about what we do is because we have so much control over the growing environment and the supply chain, we grow completely different varietals than what are sold in the store. So we'll never grow a beefsteak tomato, for example, because that thing hasn't been bred for user experience. It hasn't been bred for our enjoyment and delight. It's been bred for trucks. So we grow varietals that were bred over generations, heirloom varietals, that people grew because they were amazing. You know, like, let's grow grandma's heirloom tomatoes.
Right, out in her back garden.
Exactly. So we grow those varietals because those were bred and selected for enjoyment, not for trucks. Iceberg lettuce is...
terrible.
It's terrible. Iceberg lettuce, it only exists because in 1940, the way that we shipped lettuce was to pile a bunch of bowling balls in a freight container, pour hundreds of pounds of ice on top of them, and then ship it 3,000 miles across the country. And if you take the sweet, crispy stuff that we grow today that has that actually has nutrient content rather than just being a ball of water,
yeah,
that would be immediately unsaleable if we poured hundreds of pounds of ice on top of it.
It would just go bad or get crushed.
It would just get crushed, yeah. You know, we don't have to solve for 3,000 miles in a truck. So we're never growing iceberg lettuce.
So what's the idea then is to create a network of warehouses, farms?
Plenty farms in every community.
So like in every big city?
Yeah.
I mean, how are you rolling it? I mean, what's the kind of the near term and the long term?
So near term, there are 500 communities around the world with a million people or more.
Cities, big cities, yes, or metropolitan areas.
Metropolitan areas, yeah, right. with a million people or more. So we'll start there because 500 communities is a lot to cover. So we have a lot of plenty farms to build. But that's what we're working towards is a plenty farm or two or six in each of these towns.
So you just raised a boatload of money.
We did.
$200
million? It was $200 million, yes.
How far does that get you?
That gets us pretty far because if you think about our farms as infrastructure typically gets built out with the cheapest capital possible, which is debt. And so we plan to use the cheapest capital we can to build out most of these farms.
$200 million is a down payment, so to speak.
In a way, yeah. As we start to grow, you know, we also then have the cash or the money that we're building as we grow to use as well.
Right. But so how many locations will you be able to build before you need to raise more money?
So the answer to that, I would say both depends. It may take us beyond the constraints of this podcast for me to explain what it depends means.
Yeah.
But this definitely sets us on course towards being able to build out a farm in each of those communities.
And are you starting in the U.S.? Are you going immediately internationally all over the world? And
we're going to be international a lot sooner than people may think. In 2018, we will be both domestic and international. We're adding several locations in 2018. By 2019, we'll be deploying multiple farms per month.
Are you going to be solving Britain's tomato problem anytime soon?
Your tomatoes will be much better.
In 2018?
Not in 2018.
Right.
That will be 2019 or 2020 before we're helping to solve the UK's.
So a few more years of mealy, tasteless tomatoes.
Yes, so I apologize for those 2 years. But soon.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So you have some very interesting investors, obviously. You have SoftBank.
Yes.
So how much money have you raised total? When was the company founded?
Yeah. So in total over time, $238 million. You'll see some other announcements soon.
Further fundraisings or further closings of this fundraising?
They'll be different and distinct. SoftBank was our lead, obviously, in this round. They're extremely important because as we build out a global agricultural company, food company. You know, Masa and his team there at SoftBank have been building an international business with an international network that's extremely effective at executing. For a business with a global orientation that's centered around technology for how we get people better food, they're a great partner.
Because they've come in and are really kind of just up the stakes or up the scales of things here, because they're putting, they put $200 million into you and a couple hundred million into a bunch of companies. And so their $200 million check seems to be like a $10 million check from everybody
they
else.
They have. Well, what's super interesting is, I mean, if you look at venture capital, which is, you know, spent much of the last century building as an industry, they essentially came in with their one fund, their fund one.
Which is $100 billion. This is the one with Saudi Arabia.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So $100 billion for the SoftBank Vision Fund. They've increased the size of the global venture capital industry by about 130%. What's interesting to me about it is that as you look out over the history of venture capital, what's becoming more and more true over time is that one or two companies end up with a lion's share of the market, because in order to, whether it's search and Google, to get customers the best experience, the scale of these data sets ends up mattering a lot in terms of delivering the best experience to users. Whether it's, you know, Facebook, Amazon.
Being able to pattern recognize and tailor things accordingly.
Exactly. The scaled data sets just end up mattering a ton. You know, with this recognition in mind, SoftBank is saying, okay, look, it doesn't make sense anymore to invest. Investing in 30 or 50 companies across an industry once we have enterprise cloud business A doesn't really make sense, because so many of these aren't really going to warrant venture type investments. So let us pick who we think is in the lead, or who we, after we've evaluated the industry, let's pick the leader.
And push all your chips in.
And that's right, and build the leader. And in agriculture and in getting people better food for less money, the size of the data set, again, is going to matter a lot. And already does matter a lot in terms of...
Yeah, because there's like half a dozen others doing what you guys are doing, right?
Exactly.
And you also have Jeff Bezos.
Yes.
He was in earlier.
He was. He came in, he was one of the co-leads in the A round, in our A round financing, along with Eric Schmidt's Innovation Endeavors, which is his venture arm.
Right.
And DCM Finisterre, which is an agriculture-focused fund. Data Collective all participated in that in that round.
Do Schmidt and Bezos, do they actually get involved personally? Do they like sit down across the table and be like, what are you doing?
Eric does. Eric does. Jeff is a little bit harder because he's up the coast quite a bit.
Yeah.
So that makes it a bit harder. But I've received great counsel from Eric.
Right. I mean, strategically, obviously, Amazon's getting more and more into food. They just bought Whole Foods. Is there a path there to actually get your stuff? I mean, I guess your model is hyper local, so maybe that doesn't quite work, but.
Well, so if you look at their distribution center, or system rather, local ends up mattering a lot for them too. Whereas most of what they sell today, it doesn't have a local bent to it. To get into grocery, it really does. Just stepping back from Amazon and just speaking about online grocery, generally speaking, online grocery has a massive challenge. What's true about grocery is that fresh produce drives 6 times more traffic into the grocery store than the next highest traffic driver other than milk. And it blows away milk too.
Right.
So it blows away, it's like 3x higher than milk.
We have a really, really, really overpriced local market.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason we go there is because they have really nice produce.
Yes.
But it's like the only thing we buy there, because everything else, it's like, do you want to pay $12 for 4 cookies? I'm like, no, I'm good.
That's fantastic. I know these markets. I have one near me as well.
Yeah, sure.
And they have the corner market, the neighborhood market nailed.
Yeah.
What they know is that I have to spend another 20 minutes round trip to go anywhere else.
Exactly.
And so they completely nail me on fresh produce and milk. Now, if I'm online, I can't see it. Someone I don't know is picking it out, so I'm just not going to buy it. So if you look at the data on fresh produce and you look at the percentage of a grocery cart online versus in a store...
You're not going to buy fresh fruit and vegetables online.
That's right. Yeah. They're buying the dead stuff. And so that's where we're extremely excited to help out online grocers, is by bringing credibility to fresh produce.
And with Amazon, you can have your... beautiful iceberg lettuce delivered by drone.
Yeah, that's right.
This is the future.
That's right, except for it won't be iceberg. It'll be a sweet, crisp lettuce.
Of course.
Yeah, it'll be, you know, Celtic crunch or something like that, you know.
So, but will you be selling directly to people? Or will you be selling, you know, Safeway, plenty at found at Safeway or Amazon or whatever?
So as of today, it's the latter. But our goal is over time, we are investing in and pursuing models that get the freshest food into people's homes. And so there's more than one right answer there, but we're investing across the spectrum to do that.
Going back to where we started, so you have this big warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
How does it outperform the field? And just in terms of input, cost, time, what are you doing that you can't do at a farm?
Right. So I'll bring back the analogy of the outdoors and even a greenhouse being essentially a manufacturing business without control. And ask any manufacturer in the world whether that's something they want to do, and you'll get an emphatic no. So inside, what happens is, first of all, we remove seasonality. So now we don't have seasons. Seasons are, you know, there's obviously the sun and the temperature and the heat and the humidity and all of that. But all of those things also influence a community of bacteria in the soil that is essential to grow great tasting plants and have the kind of productivity that you need. And because those bacteria are necessary to break down nutrients. For example, in the field, you need to add a lot of nutrients because after you've grown in the field for a couple seasons, the soil is exhausted. We eliminate seasonality in that we can keep the bacterial community in the root zone consistent in the way that every crop needs to taste the best and produce at its best. We can give the plants exactly and only the nutrients they need. So we use a fraction of the nutrients that the field uses because we have a closed loop system. You know, what the plants don't use, we just feed back to them. And we use a fraction of the water, as I mentioned, so 1% the water. We have control over, you know, what the plants emit. We have control over what they take up. We can send back through what they don't. In the Salinas Valley, which is the most efficient place on the planet to grow lettuce, they're spending 15 gallons of water to grow a single head of iceberg bowling ball lettuce.
15 gallons for terrible lettuce.
15 gallons. So we are spending less than 1/5 of a gallon to grow that same head of lettuce and driving that number ever further lower. So 99% less, roughly.
Just because you're not losing it through evaporation and...
And because, you know, once it goes into the soil, you can't tell the water where to go. If it goes past the root zone, it's gone. For us, if a plant doesn't use it, we just send it back through. Plus, once soil has been used for a couple of years, it starts to lose its water retention capacity. Whereas it once was a store for water, now that water is going straight down into the water table. And so that's why you see, for example, chemical and nutrient loads in our water table increasing. Agrochemicals are getting into the water table much faster. So it also decreases the efficiency of nutrients in the field because the soil can't hold them for as long. We're just able to grow plants more efficiently. And because we don't have to mine the sun, we're growing them tall. So when you walk into our growing rooms, you'll see walls of plants 20 feet tall. You know, instead of having one plant and a footprint, you can end up having 40 plants.
Right.
So right. You know, so just a lot more.
It's like building plant skyscrapers.
That's right. Yeah. So people have moved inside and given ourselves the perfect environment. Now we're allowing plants to do the same thing.
And no pesticides.
That's right.
No fertilizer.
We have to feed nutrients to the plants just like happens out in the field. We just need a lot less of it. We don't have to feed them as much, and they end up with higher nutrient content anyway because we're growing so much more efficiently.
So are these organic?
Yes. We're the only indoor farm that is certified organic.
And how is all of this controlled? Is there like an agricultural AI, or is there must be some software or something that is kind of keeping all of this under control?
We use, you know, machine learning and deep learning to do a couple things. One is to control pests in a very targeted, non-chemical way. It allows us to watch what's happening in the plant. We can use machine vision in the infrared spectrum to watch what's happening in the plant and essentially help the plants grow as fast as possible by making sure their nutrient balance is where it should be at all times and for all stages of growth, right? Because day one is different than day five is different than day 12. And then we're also using it to do things like drive our input costs and energy consumption as low as possible. And for qualitative characteristics like, hey, how do we make sure this is spinach that a five-year-old will eat, kale that everyone will actually enjoy eating, and that kind of thing.
Presumably this all happens a lot faster. Effectively, there's never a nighttime. Never like a lack of sunlight. Yeah, I don't know if that works, if that's optimal or not.
It depends on the crop. Some of them will just work like workhorses, day in and day out. Some of them we give a little bit of a break to. But you're right. Generally speaking, they're receiving a lot more light and in more intense light. Kind of think of it like they're getting high noon light all day long. They're growing anywhere from 2 to 10 times faster, just depending on which crop we're talking about. And we're getting, instead of 1 to 4 crop cycles in a year, we're getting 13 to 20.
How much is this all this stuff going to cost? So when it comes out, is like you can have like the Rolls Royce tomato that costs $10 per.
we call this $20 lettuce versus $2 lettuce.
Yeah,
that's one of the things that drives us, is that we're not here to increase the price of food. We're here to drive it down and get people super healthy, nutrient rich diets, make that accessible to all 7.3 billion people, not just the top 0.01%. We don't enter the market until that specific crop, like say a particular heirloom lettuce, is market competitive, where we can price lower than at least 50% of what's sold in the market.
In a city, for example.
That's right.
Right.
Like if we go into New York or
London. Because being competitive
with
Whole Foods, but there's also being competitive with Trader Joe's.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we'll look at like a London, for example, and say, okay, for this crop, strawberries or lettuce or spring mix or whatever it is, for some of these crops, we can actually price lower than all of the market. The big difference here is that if you look at the way the chain works today, because the growing is so centralized in a few places, like there are only 5 Mediterranean climates on the planet. The Mediterranean climate is so meaningful to get people affordable food that the U.S., for example, we would import about 75% of our fresh produce if it weren't for California.
Oh, wow.
But because of California, we only import 35%. However, in California, like the rest of the world, we have run out of land in the places where it's economic to grow these crops. So that 35% a decade ago was much lower. It was, right, like roughly half. So if you look at seed into the home, 30 to 45% of the value of fresh fruits and vegetables is attributable to trucks and distribution centers. So we're essentially taking 30 to 45%.
Just right off the top.
Right off the top, yeah.
And recreating kind of like a super duper Ibiza in a warehouse without the nightclubs.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
This sounds like it requires a lot of energy. Is that your biggest cost?
It does. It is.
In other words, is this green, quote unquote?
Yes, because the way to think about this is, yes, we use a lot of energy. This is an energy trade-off. So the reason why 30 to 45% of the value of what's in the store today is trucks and distribution centers, I mean, that's largely energy, but it's one of the dirtiest forms of energy on the planet, which is dirty truck fuel. So essentially what we're doing is we're saying we're using clean grid energy in exchange for dirty truck fuel.
Was this a hard idea to sell initially when you're going around a venture capitalist? Did people, it was immediately
absolutely.
Like...
Absolutely. Yeah, because anyone who's investing in something has to go through kind of like a three-step process. It's first, are we as a team going to invest in this industry? Then B, what do we consider to be a great investment in this industry? What are the set of criteria? And then C, does this company fit within that spectrum? This industry is just so new, and to some people, it's compelling. But gosh, is this something that makes sense? And you're asking similar questions like, gosh, how could it make sense to build a farm and pay for energy when people are ostensibly getting the sun for free outside? But then once you're able to show, hey, we've run out of land in the places where it's economic to grow these crops, and while no one is actually writing the sun a check, the sun is imposing a particular supply chain on us that costs a lot of money, 30 to 45% of the cost being trucks and warehouses, for example. It wasn't easy. I mean, it takes people a while because we've known one form of agriculture for 10,000 years.
Well, that's why I think it's the reason I asked, is it does seem like there's more and more of this technology, venture capital, kind of looking beyond tech into other industries that, as you say, I mean, farming is bigger and more mechanized, but it's effectively the same.
Yes.
Since we started farming.
Yeah.
As yeah. humans.
Yeah, there have been a couple big innovation points. You've had like the steel plow in 1837, John Deere. In the 1890s, the tractor came about. In the 1940s, you had chemicals like fertilizers and pesticides. And in the 1980s, we had, you know, genetic modification added to the mix. And those have really been the big drivers of efficiency in ag. And this is really the next place that we go. Another thing we're solving for is food security. And that means a lot of different things. I mean, it's obvious what that means on, say, the Arabian Peninsula. But it means something actually here in the United States and in mature economies like Korea or Japan. So the average age of a grower here in the United States is 60.
It's a dying industry.
They're dying. In Korea, it's 66. In Japan, it's 68. And that's because...
Because farming sucks.
Yeah. As economies have opened up options for people where they have more control over their livelihood, why would you go into a business where you have no control over your livelihood? And not only that, it's hard to get a bank loan to buy or start a business running a 1,000 or 2,000 acre farm, which is now the minimum size you need in order to have a profitable business. And you can't go to a bank and say, hey, I'm a 35-year-old and want to start this massive business. And then if you say, well, how about a 50-acre farm? They say, well, that's not going to make any money, so yeah. We're not going to lend you that money either.
And by the way, if there's a drought or not enough rain, you're screwed.
That's right. A lot of catastrophic risk.
So is this the future?
For many crops, it is. What's going to be incredibly stunning for people is the speed at which much of what they eat is grown in this way.
Like
leafy greens and fruits like strawberries and the tomatoes that you're talking about. It's going to start there. But I will tell you that the number of crops that we are adding quarter by quarter that are market competitive is pretty stunning. The difference just between last year and this year is remarkable, actually.
I look forward to the tomatoes.
All right. Yeah, you'll like them. Yeah. Yeah. You'll find it hard to put down the strawberries, too.
And that's it. Hope you enjoyed the conversation. It's one of the more fascinating operations I've seen in a while, I must admit. And Plenty is one of those kind of new wave of companies that are starting to grow up out here that are moving beyond the traditional worlds of tech like telecoms and media, you know, moving beyond the screen in your hand or on the desk and into the real world. So I think there's lots of things like this, surprising uses of technology that we're going to start to see. So exciting times. But I digress to more important matters like podcast reviews. Please go to Apple Podcasts and do one for Danny in the Valley. It helps. And as always, you can find me elsewhere on Twitter at the handle at Danny Fortson, in the Sunday Times newspaper every weekend, and of course online at thetimes.co.uk. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.